Welcome to Transmission, the podcast that uncovers the business of clean energy. I'm Ed Porter, VP of Insights at Modo Energy, and today's episode is all about Ukraine. Since 2022, Russia has actively targeted Ukrainian energy infrastructure. Power plants have been hit, substations have been destroyed. The grid has to run with fewer big steady machines keeping it stable, and with damage that can't always be repaired fast. That's why the system is precarious, and it's why Ukraine is pushing in two directions at the same time. They're moving towards energy independence, meaning less reliance on imports or vulnerable fuel supply. And Ukraine is building stronger ties with its European allies, which means synchronizing with the NSOE grid. This ties Ukraine into a larger, more resilient system. Renewables are still being built, wind, solar, even in wartime, but variable power on a fragile grid creates its own risk. And that's where batteries come in. Today's guest, Julian Jansen, joins from Fluence, a German-based battery system provider, and the conversation is all around Fluence's work in Ukraine. 7 grid-scale batteries, around 500 megawatt hours in total, built to provide essential services like frequency support, the fast, precise balancing that keeps a weakened system from tipping over. We also need to talk about the pace of deployment. These projects were delivered in roughly 6 months, around half the usual time. And they did it with a wartime mentality, simultaneous builds, tight coordination with the grid operator, and remote commissioning. And that's the lesson Julian keeps coming back to. When the need is existential and the process is stripped back, energy infrastructure can move much faster than we tend to think. Ukraine is the extreme case, but the logic travels. So this episode is about batteries as a necessity, not as a financial product, but as critical infrastructure. Build fast, build for stability, build for a grid that has to keep working no matter what. Welcome back to Transmission. Hello, Julian, and welcome to Transmission.
Great to be here.
And our pleasure to host you. And please, could you introduce yourself and your company to our listeners?
Of course. My name is Julian Jansen. I'm a managing director at Fluence. I was responsible for our business in Southern and Eastern Europe, and right now transitioning over to take the managing director role in Germany. Fluence, to many people in the energy storage industry, it's a known name, but also for many people outside of that, it's maybe not a company you've heard of. So Fluence is one of the leading providers of battery energy storage solutions, software, and the long-term services. And we're quite unique in a way that we are only doing storage. And we came about as a joint venture in 2018 between Siemens and AES. And then in 2021, we IPO'd. So we're listed on NASDAQ. Last year, achieved just under $2.8 billion in revenue. We're active in 40 markets. We've deployed or currently deploying more than 40 gigawatt hours globally, and really driving that focus to energy storage to achieve our mission, because Fluence is fundamentally a mission-driven company transforming the way we power our world, utilizing energy storage for a more sustainable future.
I love that. And congratulations on the role change. And today we could talk about loads of things in the sort of Fluence sphere, right? Because as you say, 40 countries, you are active in many, many grids. But right now we want to talk about some of the work that you've been doing in Ukraine. So over to you. What have you been doing in Ukraine?
It's a really interesting and impactful work that we've been getting involved in Ukraine. So we've been deploying 7 large-scale battery energy storage projects in Ukraine, totaling 500 megawatt hours across those 7 projects. 6 of those with our partner DTEC and 1 other project with another player and investor in the market. And I'm saying they're very meaningful because if you think about the situation Ukraine is facing right now with the destruction of the energy infrastructure during the wartime, the role for energy storage is really amplified, and the value storage can provide is much greater than in most electricity grids. And even there, storage is already a great technology class to make grids more secure, more reliable, and ultimately integrate more renewable energy.
So let's do that. What are the specific challenges in the Ukrainian power grid that you are looking at and trying to address with storage?
I think you can break it down into 2 things. One, I would say, is call it market fundamentals, which are there regardless of the ongoing war. And the other element are wartime-induced challenges to the electricity grid. So let's start kind of maybe with the fundamentals. So in March 22, Ukraine joined the NSOE grid. The synchronization was now fully complete in January 2024. So basically, Ukraine is now trading with European electricity markets and has the same requirements for grid stability, because of course, being on the edge of that, it could have severe consequences for grid stability across the continent. At the same time, Ukraine is deploying renewables at rapid pace. So since the war started in 22, 1.8 gigawatts of renewables have been commissioned. There's another 700 megawatt of wind currently being built in Ukraine during the wartime. And there's a target of achieving 27% renewable energy penetration by 2030. So if you think about the fundamentals, it's similar to many other electricity markets in Europe. You have the synchronization with the grid stability question, and the renewable penetration. And that's leading to the typical things: more need for frequency regulation, bigger spreads on the wholesale market. But then there's also the war-related element. And I think we watch the news, we listen to the radio, people have an understanding what might be going on. But when we're sitting here in London or anywhere else in Western Europe, it's quite hard to really understand what's happening on the ground. And you think about it, since the war started, Russia has destroyed around $20.5 billion worth of energy infrastructure. So to put it into context, before the war, there was about 38 gigawatts of dispatchable generation. In the first year, we had losses of 19 gigawatts of generation capacity. That went down to 12 gigawatt total installed dispatchable capacity in 2024 after another wave of concentrated attacks. So Ukraine has lost the majority of its generation capacity. 80% of its coal-fired and hydroelectric generation has been destroyed. 73% of thermal units are no longer operational in the market. So it's facing severe challenges in the way grid infrastructure is being attacked. And it's not just generation capacity, it's substations. It's the distribution grid, it's the transmission grid. So in order to keep the lights on, and if you think about energy security and access to electricity is fundamental for security, for staying, for being in the fight of the war. And that infrastructure is being attacked every winter. And therefore, building energy storage in that situation has a heightened impact, because it helps bring grid stability, it helps restore power more quickly, and it makes the electricity grid as a whole more resilient.
Yeah, some fascinating stats. And I think it's what's really kind of clear that's come through is just how, it depends on how close you are to the news, but like just how much of a target this has been. Like if you really want to slow a country down, then taking it off grid is a very, very good way of doing that. And so some of those numbers are really striking. When we talk about Basri's role, you mentioned kind of two things at a high level, perhaps actually a third. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of the frequency response element, mm-hmm. there's the sort of energy trading element, or more sort of when there's surplus, you charge, and when there's not enough, you discharge. So the kind of classic case. And then there's also sort of restoration of the grid. For that, for the sort of 500 megawatt hours that you're installing, how do you sort of split the services across those three? Or is it possible to stack all three?
So currently, those projects were specifically built to provide ancillary services to really help restore or maintain frequency mm-hmm. off the grid. And it was specifically driven by an auction by the TSO Ukrainaga. So those assets have a very specific use case. They are able to stack some revenues. They're able to potentially trade on the wholesale market as well. And they also have certain requirements around grid forming capabilities. So in terms of grid restoration, they have some capability to also deliver that. But the first and primary use case really has been ancillary services, which has been an ongoing auction. So Ukrainaga, the TSO, has now run four auctions for ancillary services, awarded about 700 to 800 megawatt of battery energy storage, and they're planning another auction specifically for that use case. But you did mention the arbitrage element. And I think what we're seeing is there is increasing price spreads on the Ukrainian wholesale markets, and that paired with the renewable penetration is increasing the value in stacking the arbitrage with the ancillary services, similar to what we've seen in most, let's say, more mature markets. But I would say the acceleration of that journey is much quicker than anywhere else we've seen.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about the restoration of the grid, actually. It's something that We've talked a lot about this in conversations on transmission around batteries charging when there's too much and then discharging when, you know, there's not enough, and then also frequency response, and those happen quite often. Conversations around things like Black Star or trying to help grids kind of get back onto their feet, we haven't talked about that too much. You mentioned there that you can provide some services to bring a grid back up. Mm-hmm. Is that more like current injections, or is that more like a sort of whole system Black Star types?
So at the moment with this type of configuration, it's not the whole system Black Start, but of course storage has the capability to deliver that service as well. In this instance, it's much more providing the inertia that's being lost on the grid as you're destroying a lot of your thermal generation that has the kind of spinning reserves inherent to it. And of course, again, talking about what we're seeing in most grids, right, we have a transition away from those traditional generation resources, and here we just have it heightened because of the destruction. So being able to provide some of that capability, providing that synthetic inertia to the grid, is very critical. But the primary use case still remains on the ancillary service. The other element I think that in the Ukrainian context is important is the distributed nature of these projects. So rather than building one very large project, you're distributing the assets, which from a distribution system perspective allows you to maintain potential grid stability or maintain electricity when maybe there's outages on the wider grid because of the attacks. So the distributed nature here plays a very, very pivotal role as well for grid stability.
Yeah, so imagine every single one of these units is essentially trying to keep that grid frequency where it should be. And if they're sort of 200, 300 kilometers apart, if something severs in between the two, then you've still got assets on either side.
Correct.
And you mentioned there were 500 megawatt hours. Mm-hmm. Did you say there were seven sites? Right. Okay. So roughly speaking, we're in the realm of that sort of 50 to 100 megawatts type size, slightly smaller?
Yeah, slightly smaller. So most of the projects are between 20 and 50 megawatt, 2 hour duration today.
Okay, yes. Oh, that's where the doubling is coming from. Okay, so 2 hours was kind of selected as the option, which is very sort of traditional for ancillary services and that type of restoration. I think maybe just to give people a bit of context as why that feels slightly smaller than other assets that someone like Fluence deploys, maybe do you want to give a little sort of taster of some of the sizes you're looking at, for example, in Germany?
Yeah, I think that's right, because give you one example. In Germany, we just signed the largest storage project in Europe, which is a 4 gigawatt hour, so 1 gigawatt, 4 hour duration asset. So you look at the scale, it's obviously a huge difference. And when we look at pipelines across the market, whether it's in GB, whether that's in markets like Germany, we're starting to see really a lot of projects move into the very high hundreds of megawatt hours or even gigawatt hours. In Ukraine, I think it had a couple of key elements. One was just the auction size, right? The auction awarded a limited capacity, so people were building smaller projects to meet that. Part of it was sites, so being able to find sites that are able to be brought online within the very short period that developers were given by Ukrenerga to meet the deadline of getting the projects online from that first auction before winter 2025. So that was a really critical element for site selection. So when you go bigger, it's very hard to meet that timeline. You might have to procure high voltage equipment, etc. Here, smaller size was allowed those projects to go faster, and also to a certain extent kind of investment volume of the projects, right? You're operating in a wartime environment. Yes, you're getting a 5-year back contract by the grid operator, but of course, as let's say limited international investors that are going into that market. But at the same time, Ukrainian banks are funding those type of mechanisms. But again, the checks you're writing are not going to be able to build a 4 gigawatt hour project. But also the total need on the ancillary services was defined by about 1 gigawatt in total. So you can kind of put one and one together and see why you've got a build out of a larger number of smaller sites rather than the very large projects we see elsewhere in Europe.
Okay, makes sense. We'll definitely come back to that piece around the speed of delivery later on, but let's just stay with the sort of wartime theme, right? So how is the project different to a traditional project that Fluence would do? So sort of where did you say, actually, this is as far as kind of Fluence will take this, and we're going to pass over to our partners at this point?
The fundamental differences for this project, one was speed. So we'll come to that a little bit later and have a discussion around it, but just the real, let's say, heightened requirement to bring the asset online. The other element was how it was being delivered, right? That was really a complete different way on how we've traditionally done it. Fluence invests a lot of money and people, being close to a market, being local, having having staffing from sales through project management all the way through services. And of course, given the conditions, we were unable to hire in Ukraine and send our people to Ukraine. So we developed a unique concept for us at the time, which was to commission those assets remotely, to train our partners' teams on how to commission the assets, how to install the assets, but also then how to service the assets. And for us, that was also quite critical if you think about the need for investment and upskilling the sector in Ukraine, right? There's a lot of very good engineering capability, but very limited experience with storage. So by training our customers and partners' teams, we've really helped upskill the sector. And we now have dozens and dozens of people there that are able to install, commission these assets and service them. And that was really quite the unique aspect. So we're now through the process of the commissioning, we supported it remotely, and the team on the ground were able to then carry out the commissioning work. And then, of course, there's a few, let's say, smaller items to navigate, logistics, right? How to actually get the assets into the country. And then on the operational side, okay, again, training up the teams to service the assets going forward. But I also think that is definitely an area, as we have more productization in the industry, it is something that was unique for these projects that offers such great learning and is already being implemented in the way we're approaching projects going forward, and being able to maybe serve more customers across more segments and more geographies through a similar model.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation.
I'd love to ask a question, and maybe we're going to have to cut this one out, but just around the level of secrecy in the project. Was it like delivering a project to any other supplier, or was it very much sort of, even within Fluence, it was kind of only a few people knew that certain projects were going in certain places? Was it all kind of a little bit under the radar?
Yes, it was. So, I mean, actually, it started doing the project required the highest level of buy-in. So we really build a structured case why we should be doing these projects. You know, really in the end, it came down to our mission, right? We believe that there's no project that align greater to our mission of transforming the way we power world. And, you know, whatever you might say, a lot of our teams are very driven by the mission. I'm very driven by the mission. And yes, we're a large publicly listed company, but that's still an inherent motivation. So there's a really clear case of why we wanted to do these projects. And it was motivated much more by the mission element than any commercial aspects. On top of that, in terms of the secrecy, yes, it was treated very different than most projects. So in terms of site location, for obvious reasons, you know, we cannot disclose the site locations. Even within our internal teams, there was no sharing or knowledge of site locations. The partner knew obviously where the sites were, and only a very core team that was working on the commissioning was working through that. I had the pleasure of visiting one of the sites back in September, which was, you know, quite a proud moment for me personally. But it really had to go that way, because as you can imagine, this is critical infrastructure. And even going forward, those sites, of course, will not be disclosed or known publicly. So really critical element for us to make sure that they stay online and continue providing the value that they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know you'd been to the site, so I would love to just hear a couple of lines about going to the site. What were the things you were looking out for? Was it sort of was it a practical visit, or was it also just a more of a visit just with partners, really, just to kind of celebrate the work that had been done?
That one was actually a little bit more the celebratory element, so to speak. It was the formal inauguration of the site. So they'd gone through the market testing with the grid operator, and this was really now the final inauguration energization. So obviously still some minor work that is happening remotely, but all those assets mm-hmm. are now operating and are discharging and charging electricity. So it was a little bit more from that element for me personally, working with our partners, mm-hmm. showcasing the project, engaging with key stakeholders locally to explain what the technology does. But it was also important to see how it's been installed. Does it meet all of the requirements that we put in place in terms of this is what a site should look like? If you're not actually on site, it's very hard to check and oversee that. And it was very impressive. It was one of the most impressive projects in terms of build quality, installation that I've seen. And it was a great moment to see that and work with our partners to deliver it.
Because you can always look at a dashboard of sort of lights and try and work out what the problem is. And you can always look at photos and try and work out, has that been installed the wrong way? But actually, sometimes you have to be there to see whether something is as it should be.
Yeah. Okay. But it was. I think that was the great moment. Being able to walk the site, see how it's been installed. Yeah, as I said, I think it was just a very powerful moment to be in Kyiv and see the site there, see it operating and the impact it's making. And long may it continue.
Very good. And hopefully more projects coming through. We talked a lot earlier about the speed of these sites coming through. So you mentioned, I think, 6 months from start to finish, or getting the projects there in time for winter. Mm-hmm. Just to give listeners some context, is that significantly faster than most other battery projects? And how did you do that?
Yeah, it is significantly faster. So I think if you use a comparable size, right, of course, a larger project will often take a bit longer anyway, but comparable size, you would typically be looking at around a 12-month delivery period, right? That includes everything from manufacturing to shipping the systems to then installing and commissioning and then connecting to the grid, running through all the market testing, etc. So 12 months typically in the industry has been seen as fairly quickly. If you look at some assets, mainly due to grid connection requirements, grid testing requirements, often delayed significantly. So I think here that makes those projects unique from signing the contract in January to starting the delivery in spring, and then having all the market tested completed over the summer was really a big lift and a big effort by teams on our side, but especially from our partners and customers in the market. So it is quite unique in that sense. How is it done? I think it needs a lot of buy-in from us, from the customer, but then also from the grid operator, right? And there was a clear goal: these assets need to be online before the winter period, because that's the most, challenging period for the electricity system in Ukraine. So it was really accelerating the production schedule, having a lot of people on site for the installation and commissioning of the asset. Now, luckily, our partners have a big team of engineers that they were able to bring across and to deliver that. And of course, from our side, providing all of the remote support to enable that, which is significant as you're doing it in parallel rather than sequencing the commissioning, which you would typically do on an asset. So bringing individual cores online simultaneously across multiple sites rather than just sequencing and starting one by one and going, the team goes from one to the next. So that was really an important effort there from everyone. And then ultimately the grid operator doing the testing very quickly, very rapidly. But of course, that was a mutual interest because they needed those assets online as well.
Yeah, it's kind of really striking, right? If you were to compare some projects in some areas of the world, you could be, say, 7 or 8 years before, like, from initial inception through to project delivered, right? It really could be something like 14 times longer than how long it took you to get those projects deployed. So I think that is really striking. And we do often hear that people kind of say, we almost need like a wartime mentality or like a COVID-like response to go ahead and try and decarbonize sector faster. And I think this is really what they mean, right? That if everything aligns in the right direction, you can get these projects moving very quickly and you can get it done within 6 and 12 months. One sort of thing stands out for me. Do you think sort of more broadly with Influence, do you think you'll try and sort of use remote commissioning more often now that you've tested it out in possibly the hardest conditions? Do you think you'll now look to go ahead and do that in more places?
Yeah, absolutely. The learnings to be taken from these projects are huge, right? All the way through the whole kind of process, including, let's say, the contracting and how we move quickly through the production, how we prioritize, and then in the end, the training and remote commissioning models. I think it does depend on the type of project, the type of location, the type of segment, because often for the very large scale projects, it's still the better option for us to carry out the whole work. We sell a lot of turnkey projects as well, where we don't just provide the technology, but we carry out the whole construction of the entire project. So obviously on those sites, that type of model wouldn't work anyway. But certainly to access more segments, to also deliver, let's say, within the smaller parts of the market where project sizes are a little bit smaller, to go into geographies where maybe this is very complementary, and also taking the learnings into our next generation product where we speed up the commissioning significantly, which is a good thing when we're delivering the project. But the easier and faster the commissioning is, because we do it front ended, the easier and faster it is to deliver it in this type of model.
Mm-hmm. When you say you do your commissioning front ended, what do you mean?
So we're doing a lot more on the software within the factory. So when the product actually ships, what you have is a lot of pre-installed software. Commissioning is a lot faster once it lands on site, and you don't necessarily need the same size of commissioning team going from each enclosure to the next enclosure to basically start the commissioning somewhat more manually.
Yeah, makes sense. And one final question on Ukraine then. So what does the sort of long-term plan look like? I saw a number out there for 500 megawatts of battery storage being considered, obviously a larger number than today. But do you see kind of storage evolving into something that can go beyond frequency response and to provide resilience for longer periods?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, let's look at kind of the facts. So, right, I said earlier, there's this 27% renewable target that Ukrainoga has got and that Ukraine has got. So you obviously have the fundamentals are moving in the right direction. You have a real need for flexibility, because if you think about because of the destruction, you now have about 7.7 gigawatts of nuclear capacity across three power plants. But that's not a flexible generation technology, right? So you have a very strong base load, and you have a lot of renewables on top of it. And a lot of your flexible generation has been destroyed or is under attack. So storage comes in and can really fill that gap from a system perspective. If you think of kind of a nuclear renewable hybrid system, storage is almost like the perfect complementary technology to manage the flexibility requirements within that. So there's clearly a need. There's going to be another auction, or at least it's planned to have another auction for the ancillary services, but there's also more and more interest in co-locating with renewable plants. So then in those cases, it's slightly smaller project sizes. And we're starting to see, I believe, in the arbitrage case. I mentioned earlier, we're seeing quite significant spreads on the wholesale market in Ukraine, and there's a lot of buy-in from certain investors that will continue. So we're also starting to see a shift in duration. It depends a little bit on your kind of risk appetite, I would say, and you believe in the long-term fundamentals of the market and the availability of capital. But when you do, we're starting to see customers looking at longer duration assets, whether that's 4 hours or even above that, because they see the spreads in the market potentially driving a payback on this longer duration type of asset. For us, directly, we have about a 1 gigawatt hour pipeline of additional projects in Ukraine. Hopefully, many of those will be realized in the coming years. And we're going to continue working with our partners there, but also doing more than that, right? Helping people understand the role the technology can play, working with stakeholders within the electricity system to really highlight what else storage can do beyond the ancillary services, especially as you're rebuilding a grid that is transformed post-war with storage, with renewables and other technologies.
Yeah, it's a super exciting time, right? As storage goes from this sort of ancillary service provider into something that does multiple hours and a longer duration. I don't sort of hesitate to say long duration, because it's a bit of a moving number, but certainly longer duration. And we see that in Germany as well. So, I mean, we've been looking at sort of the saturation of those ancillary markets and how the sort of best duration for some of those battery assets is now looking like 4 hours, you know, was 2 hours, now looking at four. It's a repeated theme from battery markets all over the world. And I'm sure you're seeing it too in the orders that are, and well, it obviously is coming through, because you mentioned a 4 gigawatt hour project that earlier on in this episode.
Yeah, it is completely coming through. And I mean, why is it happening? I think one, it's the spreads of the market are starting to justify that investment case. But I think the other piece is grid connections are incredibly valuable right now. If you can have the grid connection, but increase the energy that you're storing on that same side and deliver additional value from that, and maybe look a bit more long-term, because it's going to be very hard to get another grid connection for the next project. Well, let's go 4 hours straight away, take a little bit of risk into the future, but potentially have a much higher payback in the medium to long-term on that same project. The other thing that I think that we're seeing, though, is that a lot of sites are quite constrained. So people have planned on 2 hours, they're now looking to expand to 4 hours, but they have land constraints, they have permit constraints in terms of noise. So what's really great to see, and especially in the German context, now with Fluence's new product, the SmartStack product, which is higher and drives a lot higher density at a site level, we're starting to see projects that are being enabled to go from 2 to 4 hours within the current permit conditions. And that's obviously extremely valuable for a developer because you're not having to re-permit, but you can already shift to 4 hours, take advantage of the greater economies of scales, lower costs that we continue to see coming down on the battery side, and max out your grid connection with a 4 hour asset that fits onto that side.
It's such an exciting trend, you know, that those batteries that went in 5 years ago, turns out you can just lift them out, put in something that's the same 20-foot shape and yet could be giving you three times, four times the duration because the tech has got so much better. I would say that that Fluence asset, has it also got a bit taller as well?
Yes, it has, kind of gone
from a standard 20-foot shipping container to like, is it a high cube? Is that the right height for it now?
It's about 4 meters 10, 4 meters 20. So okay, a lot higher than a standard shipping container. There's also obviously ability to change the structure on the same product platform. That's a little bit the philosophy behind it. But at current level, it's kind of in those realms.
So there's some flexibility in terms of how you configure
that product. Yes. But for us, it's really about bringing two things together. And I think the whole industry went density, density, density. Like, how do we pack as much as possible into the same 20-foot enclosure? Mm. But then the problem is you start having issues around weight. Suddenly that thing weighs 45, 50 tons. Yeah. How do you maneuver it? How do you install it? You need special cranes. You need special transport. So for us, it kind of went back to the drawing board and looked at our roots when we had a very, very modular product, which at the time was great for where the market was. It was like, how do you bring the density and the modularity together? And that's how SmartSkid was born, where you have the SmartSkid at the bottom and you put the battery pods on top of that SmartSkid. Mm-hmm. And through that, achieved a higher density because you're going higher. But you also have the modularity required for logistics and installation because you're not installing or delivering and installing it as a single enclosure.
And if you can get everything onto the back of a lorry and lift it with non-specialized cranes, it makes everything much cheaper.
That's right.
That's the secret sauce.
That's right. And I think what people are forgetting, right, if you're now reducing a lot of the cost around the battery storage system, the impact is much higher, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't that long ago that the battery made up probably 60-75% of total project cost, right? But that total project cost proportion has massively come down, and depending a little bit how you count all the different elements, but it's probably down to about 35-40% in terms of the core battery enclosure and inverter element. So if you're now reducing other costs as well, if you're reducing the installation costs, if you're reducing the civil works that is required, the cabling that's required, how much concrete you're pouring for foundations, the proportional effect of those cost savings is significantly greater than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting, right? So we're now starting to look around the edges to see where else we can save in addition to having a much cheaper battery on site. Now, we've talked a bit about GB, we've certainly talked about Ukraine, and we've talked about Germany, but in your role, you're looking at growing markets or emerging markets. What other markets are exciting for you?
For me personally, Poland is a really exciting market. I mean, a lot of people and investors have woken up to the fact that there's a great opportunity for storage in Poland over the last kind of 18 months, but I still think there's a lot more runway there. And it's just looking at the fundamentals of that market. You have a lot of renewable build out. You have a very inflexible coal fleet. Eventually that coal has to be phased out, albeit slowly given the political challenges of that in Poland. So you're then looking at where does the flexibility needs to come from. And it's not going to come from natural gas from a geopolitical perspective. That's not that desirable. So storage has a really key role to play in the Polish market. So very excited about the prospects there, you know, probably up to about 20 gigawatt hours by 2030 is what we expect in that market. The other market, I think everyone is fully aware of, just in a scale and speed perspective, is now the Italian market. I think a lot has been talked about it, so I won't go into too much depth, but just the level of commitment from the grid operator, right, to go from And the Italian market, it's interesting because it's kind of the fourth phase, if you think about it, right? It started with some pilot projects and there was a specific Turner pilot between the north and south. And at the time, it was like the largest storage project in the world. I think it's back 2014, 15. Then it kind of died. Then they had a fast reserve auction, which was a really interesting concept on the ancillary services. Then that was a one-off market opportunity. Then they had a big capacity market auction where over a gigawatt was awarded. Then nothing happened for 2-3 years. We're actually in the fourth deployment phase and people are like, oh, Italy is interesting, right? But it is way more advanced. But now Turner is going to be procuring 50 gigawatt hours in a three-year period for the Maxi auction. So really interesting market from a scale perspective now. And if you think about the levels of market development, I think it's very curious because a lot of people have forgotten that it is actually the fourth phase of deployment there. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm really always keep an eye out for is where Spain is. Again, some more ambitious discussions coming out of Spain. I lovingly call Spain market development purgatory. I have a long career in market analysis and then new market development. And to me, it feels like it kind of perpetually stuck in market development purgatory. But I think now, after the PERTE scheme and now some of the more aggressive targets and regulatory changes, I'm hoping it can kind of come out of that hibernation and be a core market. Because again, look at fundamentals. Spain should be the most attractive storage market in Europe, right? Very limited interconnection, very high renewable penetration, great opportunity, a lot, you know, land available, etc. And then I think, you know, from a scale perspective, we don't necessarily see it that much when we're kind of in Europe or in GB. But last year, I spent a lot of my time in the Middle East, and the scale of individual projects, it is just eye-watering when you're comparing to the types of projects that are being built here. Again, right? Grid connections, probably a lot easier to achieve. Land is certainly less of a challenge than maybe if you're in kind of dense south of England. But again, the scale that's coming out of there, and the way scale across the globe drives ultimately also the competitiveness of storage in European markets, I think is something to keep an eye out, because that continues to drive down cost, improves performance, and just firmly establishes lithium-ion batteries as the core technology, now scaling obviously all the way through the 6, 8, 12 hour duration as well.
Do you think some of these additional grids or some of these other grids have got lucky is the wrong wording, but by being a second mover, right? So California CAISO is already 15 gigs, 50 gigawatt hours plus. So, you know, bigger than those markets we just talked about. It feels like if you built projects really extensively over the last 10 years, you sort of paid some of the higher prices for them. And now we're getting into this time where not only are we sort of starting to optimize the batteries themselves, but we're also starting to optimize how they go on the back of lorries and how we sort of reduce costs from cranes to put them into place. So we're getting to that game where we're really trying to like get the last sort of few bits of cost out of the system. Do you think some of those grids that are second movers are really going to come up trumps in terms of having the lowest cost deployment of storage on their system?
I don't think so. And there's two reasons. One, because I don't think we're at the point where we're really squeezing out the last cost, right? If you think about the deployment curve of storage, we're still pretty early on in the deployment curve in most markets and globally seen. So I think there's still a lot more to do. I think it's only really over the last 2-3 years that we've seen a shift on the battery manufacturing side. Storage has become a lot more of a focus, a lot more suppliers in there. We've seen performance improvement. We've seen density improvements. We've seen cost declines, right? So it's not just you're reducing costs. No, you're reducing costs while improving the performance and the density of the same technology. So I think we're really still quite... we're not at the end of that, and especially when you're looking at longer duration, optimizing the product design and improving the overall competitiveness of 6, 8, 12 hour storage solutions using lithium-ion batteries, there's still a lot of runway in my eyes to go. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of point one, because we're not at the end yet. But also, you have to think about, for me, it's the wrong way of saying, okay, the people who went early or the grids that moved early are somewhat being punished, because at the time they had a need, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's just a natural progression. There were markets where that need was heightened at an earlier stage. And then there's markets where that need is coming more to the fore today. And at the same time, storage has become more competitive, so it's easier to tackle more applications. But we wouldn't be at that point if there wouldn't have been grids that would have had that need and storage was able to meet that need back then.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, let's move on to our final two questions. So is there anything you'd like to plug?
What would I like to plug? I think I mentioned earlier I'm moving roles. I'm going to take over in the German market. And I think just the excitement of the German market right now, it's palpable. Again, right, a lot of people are aware of it. A lot of people want to buy projects there. But I think the scale and how many large projects, I mentioned the 4 gigawatt hour project earlier, but how many large projects are now coming through over the next 2-2.5 years in the German market, I think is really going to be something people sit up and take note. So I think for me that's really clear. It's our capabilities investment in Germany, but across Europe, right? Fluence has a very European heritage, even though, you know, we're headquartered in the US, but we have a strong team, over 400 people across Europe. A lot of value creation happening, right? We're not just selling here. We have teams that are doing the product development, the testing, software development happening in our lab in Erlangen and across our locations in Europe. So we really have that strong local understanding, and we help customers on that whole journey, right? It's not about giving you a box filled with batteries. It's about helping you make more money from this asset. And that's how we want to approach it and how we bring that together. So kind of plugging a little bit Germany, but also the value that has to be created in market. I think it's often overlooked when people are just kind of driving the cost down and they're forgetting the whole business case behind it.
I totally agree. Time after time, we look at these battery projects and there's sort of a perception that the availability of an asset is commoditized, the duration of the asset is commoditized, the location doesn't matter. And actually, when you do the forecasting for all of these parts, the duration, the location, the warranty commitment that you make, the types of services you go with, the optimizer that you use who chooses how your battery actually operates, all matters. It's all significant.
Absolutely. So, the way you service the project. How quickly are you on site? Are you smart enough to understand that, and take the German context, you probably don't want to be doing any plant maintenance after April in Germany because that's when you're more likely to make higher revenues, right? Do you really think about that as you're building and servicing the asset? And is your technology partner thinking about that? Or are they saying, here's a box filled of batteries, your problem?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, we really see that. I think we really see it in markets like Texas, where in ERCOT we had a crazy stat, something like, this was a couple of years ago, something like 70 or 80% of the annual revenues were in 10 days. And it's sort of, I think it actually may have been a higher percentage than that. And it's like, well, look, if you organized your outage at the wrong time, you really paid for it. Anyway, and moving on to the final question. So is there a contrarian view that you hold?
Somewhat. I don't know if it is that contrarian, but I do a lot of work at a European Union policy level. So I'm one of the vice presidents of Energy Storage Europe. And because of that, I've had a lot of kind of exposure to what's happening in Brussels and some of the trends we're seeing. And what, as a, I would say, quite a proud European and also a believer in the European continent and what we're offering as a whole, right? Everyone included, not just the institutions. I see a lot of worry in a changing world around how we keep our grid secure. So from a cybersecurity standpoint, how do we make sure that what we're building now, it's critical grid infrastructure, right? I'm not talking about a 20 megawatt PV plant where an outage doesn't matter. We saw what happened in Spain when there was a blackout, and there may not be a relation, but you see, we are so reliant on electricity, right? We're so reliant for our daily life, but we're even more reliant from a security aspect. So energy security is security. And whether we like it or not, we are living in a changing world where there's a lot more threats to our way of life, to our values, to our democracy. So having a risk within our critical electricity infrastructure on a cyber perspective, to me, is very, very worrying. And I think what, and maybe this is what's somewhat contrarian, we need to understand, is there risk of kind of ripping it out and replacing it? We've seen what happened in 5G networks. And I think we have to ask ourselves, one, what do we want in our electricity grids? What is important for us as a European continent? And secondly, if we're developing projects, is there risk that I have to respond to changing regulation in 1, 2, 3 years' time because the world is changing around us?
Yeah. I think truly contrarian that we haven't had it mentioned before, and we're at least 200 episodes in. So I think definitely points for that. Yeah, for sure. We aren't thinking about this enough. And so I think that's a great place to leave it. Julian, thank you. You've been a wonderful guest, and I'm sure we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you very much for having me. It was great fun.